their shops brim with shoes plucked off the dead. Look at them. What he feels on the worst days of that relentless winter, while rust colonizes the truck and rifles and radios, while German divisions retreat all around them, is a deep scorn for all the humans they pass. The smoking, ruined villages, the broken pieces of brick in the street, the frozen corpses, the shattered walls, the upturned cars, the barking dogs, the scurrying rats and lice. How can they live like that? Out here in the forests, in the mountains, in the villages, they are supposed to be pulling up disorder by the root. The total entropy of any system, said Dr. Hauptmann, will decrease if the entropy of another system will increase. Nature demands symmetry. Ordnung muss sein. And yet, what order are they making out here? The suitcases, the queues, the wailing babies, the soldiers pouring back into the cities with eternity in their eyes. In what system is order increasing? Surely not in Kiev, or Lvov, or Warsaw. It's all Hades. There are just so many humans, as if huge Russian factories cast new men every minute. Kill 1,000, and we'll make 10,000 more. February finds them in the mountains. Ferner shivers in the back of the truck while Neumann 1 grinds down switchbacks. Trenches snake below them in an endless net. German positions on one side, Russian positions beyond. Thick ribbons of smoke stripe the valley. Occasional flares of ordnance fly like shuttlecocks. Folkheimer unfolds a blanket and wraps it around Werner's shoulders. His blood sloshes back and forth inside him like mercury. And outside the windows, in a gap in the mist, the network of trenches and artillery below shows itself very clearly for a moment, and Werner feels he is gazing down into the circuitry of an enormous radio, each soldier down there an electron flowing single file down his own electrical path, with no more say in the matter than an electron has. Then they're around a bend, and he feels only the presence of Folkheimer next to him, a cold dusk out the windows, bridge after bridge, hill after hill, all the time descending. Metallic, tattered moonlight shatters across the road, and a white horse stands chewing in a field, and a searchlight rakes the sky, and in the lit window of a mountain cabin, for a split second as they rumble past, Werner sees Jutta, seated at a table. The bright faces of other children around her, Frau Elena's needlepoint over the sink, the corpses of a dozen infants heaped in a bin beside the stove. The Third Stone. He stands in a chateau outside Amiens, north of Paris. The big old house moans in the dark. The home belongs to a retired paleontologist, and von Rumpel believes it is here that the chief of security at the museum in Paris fled during the chaos following the invasion of France 3 years ago. A peaceful place, insulated by fields and wombed in hedges. He climbs a staircase to a library. A bookshelf has been peeled open. The strongbox is behind it. The Gestapo safecracker is good, whereas a stethoscope does not bother with a flashlight. In a few minutes, he has it open. An old handgun, a box of certificates, a stack of tarnished silver coins, and inside a velvet box, a blue pear-cut diamond. The red heart inside the stone shows itself 1 second, becomes completely inaccessible the next. Inside von Rumpel, hope braids with desperation. He is almost there. The odds are in his favor, aren't they? But he knows before he sets it under the lamp. That same elation crashing out of him. The diamond is not real. It, too, is the work of DuPont. He has found all three fakes. All his luck is spent. The doctor says the tumor is growing again. The prospects of the war are nosediving. Germany retreats across Russia, across the Ukraine, up the ankle of Italy. Before long, everyone in the Einsatzstab Reichsleiter Rosenberg, the men out there scouring the continent for hidden libraries, concealed prayer scrolls, closeted impressionist paintings, will be handed rifles and sent into the fire, including Von Rumpel. So long as he keeps it, the keeper of the stone will live forever. He cannot give up, and yet his hands grow so heavy, his head is a boulder. One at the museum, one to the home of a museum supporter, one sent with a chief of security. What sort of man would they choose for a third courier? The Gestapo man watches him, his attention on the stone, his left hand on the door of the strongbox. Not for the first time, Von Rumpel thinks of the extraordinary jewel safe at the museum, like a puzzle box. In all his travels, he has seen nothing else like it. Who could have conceived of it? The Bridge. In a French village far to the south of Saint-Malo, a German truck crossing a bridge is blown up. 6 German soldiers die. Terrorists are blamed. Night and fog, whisper the women who come by to check on Marie-Laure. For every Kraut lost, they'll kill 10 of us. Police go door to door demanding any able-bodied man come out for a day's work. Dig trenches, unload railway wagons, push barrows of cement bags, construct invasion obstacles in a field or on a beach. Everyone who can must work to strengthen the Atlantic Wall. Etienne stands squinting in the doorway with his doctor's notes in his hand, cold air blowing over him and fear billowing backward into the hall. Madame Ruel whispers that occupation authorities are blaming the attack on an elaborate network of anti-occupation radio broadcasts. She says that crews are busy locking away the beaches behind a network of concertina wire and huge wooden jacks. Already they have restricted access to the walkways atop the ramparts. She hands over a loaf and Marie-Laure carries it home. When Etienne breaks it open, there is yet another piece of paper inside. 9 more numbers. "I thought they might take a break," he says. Marie-Laure is now thinking of her father. "Maybe," she says, "it is even more important now." He waits until dark. Marie-Laure sits in the mouth of the wardrobe, the false back open, and listens to her uncle switch on the microphone and transmitter in the attic. His mild voice speaks numbers into the garret. Then music plays, soft and low, full of cellos tonight, and it cuts out midstream. "Uncle." It takes him a long time to come down the ladder. He takes her hand, he says, "The war that killed your grandfather killed 16 million others. 1.5 million French boys alone, most of them younger than I was. 2 million on the German side. March the dead in a single file line, and for 11 days and 11 nights they'd walk past our door. This is not rearranging street signs, what we're doing, Murray. This is not misplacing a letter at the post office. These numbers, they're more than numbers. Do you understand? But we are the good guys, aren't we, Uncle?" "I hope so. I hope we are." Rue des Patriarches. Von Rumpel enters an apartment house in the 5th arrondissement. The simpering landlady on the first floor takes the sheaf of ration tickets he offers and buries them in her housecoat. Cats swarm her ankles. Behind her, an over-decorated flat reeks of dead apple blossoms, confusion, old age. "When did they leave, madame?" "Summer of 1940. She looks as if she might hiss. "Who pays the rent?" "I don't know, monsieur." "Do the checks come from the Natural History Museum?"
"I can't say."
"When was the last time someone came?"
"No one comes. The checks are mailed."
"From where?"
"I don't know." and no one leaves or enters the flat? Not since that summer, she says, and retreats with her vulture face and vulture fingernails into the redolent dark. Up he goes. A single deadbolt on the fourth floor marks the locksmith's flat. Inside, the windows are boarded over with wood veneer, and an airless, pearly light seeps through the knotholes. As though he has climbed into a dark box hung inside a column of pure light. Cabinets hang open. Sofa cushions sit slightly cockeyed. A kitchen chair is toppled on its side. Everything speaks of a hasty departure or a rigorous search, or both. A black rim of algae rings the toilet bowl where the water has slipped away. He inspects the bedroom, bathroom, kitchen, some fiendish and immitigable hope flaring within him. What if? Along the top of a workbench stand tiny benches, tiny lampposts, tiny trapezoids of polished wood. Little vise, little box of nails, little bottles of glue long since hardened. Beside the bench, beneath a drop cloth, a surprise. A complicated model of the Fifth Arrondissement. The buildings are unpainted but otherwise beautifully detailed. Shutters, doors, windows, storm drains. No people. A toy. In the closet hang a few moth-eaten girls' dresses and a sweater on which embroidered goats chew flowers. Dusty pine cones line the windowsill, arranged large to small. On the floor of the kitchen, friction strips have been nailed into the wood. A place of quiet discipline, calm order. A single line of twine runs between the table and the bathroom. A clock stands dead without glass on its face. It's not until he finds three huge spiral-bound folios of Jules Verne in Braille that he solves it. A safe maker. Brilliant with locks. Lives within walking distance of the museum. Employed there all his adult life. Humble. No visible aspirations for wealth. A blind daughter. Plenty of reasons to be loyal. Where are you hiding? He says aloud to the room. The dust swirls in the strange light. Inside a bag or a box. Tucked behind a baseboard or stashed in a compartment beneath the floorboards, or plastered up inside a wall. He opens the kitchen drawers and checks behind them, but the previous searchers would have checked all this. Slowly, his attention returns to the scale model of the neighborhood. Hundreds of tiny houses with mansard roofs and balconies. It is this exact neighborhood, he realizes. Colorless and depopulated and miniaturized. A tiny, spectral version of it. One building in particular appears smoothed and worn by the insistence of fingers. The building he's in. Home. He puts his eye to street level, becomes a god looming over the Latin Quarter. With two fingers, he could pinch out anyone he chooses, nudge half a city into shadow, flip it upside down. He sets his fingers atop the roof of the apartment house in which he kneels. It lifts free of the model easily, as though designed to do so. He rotates it in front of his eyes. 18 little windows, 6 balconies, a tiny entrance door. Down here, behind this window, lurks the little landlady with her cats. And here, on the fourth floor, himself. On its bottom, he finds a tiny hole. Not at all unlike the keyhole in the jewel safe in the museum he saw 3 years before. The house is, he realizes, a container, a receptacle. He plays with it a while, trying to solve it. He turns it over, tries the bottom, the side. His heart rate soars. Something wet and feverish rises onto his tongue. Do you have something inside of you? Von Rumpel sets the little house on the floor, raises his foot, and crushes it. White City. In April 1944, the Opel rattles into a white city full of empty windows,
Vienna, says Folkheimer. And Neumann, too, fulminates about Habsburg palaces and Wiener Schnitzel, and girls whose vulvas taste like apple strudel. They sleep in a once stately old-world suite, with the furniture shored up against the walls, and chicken feathers clogging the marble sinks and newspapers tacked clumsily across the windows. Down below, a switching yard presents a wilderness of train tracks. Werner thinks of Dr. Hauptmann with his curls and fur-lined gloves, whose Viennese youth Werner imagined spent in vibrant cafes where scientists-to-be discussed Bohr and Schopenhauer, where marble statues stared down from ledges like kindly godparents. Hauptmann, who presumably is still in Berlin, or at the front like everyone else. The city commander has no time for them. A subordinate tells Folkheimer there are reports of resistance broadcasts washing out of the Leopoldstadt. Round and round the district they drive. Cold fog hangs in the budding trees, and Werner sits in the back of the truck and shivers. The place smells to him of carnage. For 5 days he hears nothing on his transceiver but anthems and recorded propaganda and broadcasts from beleaguered colonels requesting supplies, gasoline, men. It is all unraveling. Werner can feel it, the fabric of the war tearing apart. That's the Staatsoper, says Neumann II one night. The facade of a grand building rises gracefully, pilastered and crenellated. Stately wings soar on either side, somehow both heavy and light. It strikes Werner just then as wondrously futile to build splendid buildings, to make music, to sing songs, to print huge books full of colorful birds in the face of the seismic, engulfing indifference of the world. What pretensions humans have. Why bother to make music when the silence and the wind are so much larger? Why light lamps when the darkness will inevitably snuff them, when Russian prisoners are chained by threes and fours to fences, while German privates tuck live grenades in their pockets and run? Opera houses. Cities on the moon. Ridiculous. They would all do better to put their faces on the curbs and wait for the boys who come through the city dragging sledges stacked with corpses. At mid-morning, Folkheimer orders them to park in the Augarten. The sun burns away the fog and reveals the first blooms on the trees. Werner can feel the fever flickering inside him. A stove with its door latched. Neumann I, who, if he were not scheduled to die 10 weeks from now in the Allied invasion of Normandy, might have become a barber later in life, who would have smelled of talc and whiskey and put his index finger into men's ears to position their heads, whose pants and shirt always would have been covered with clipped hairs, who, in his shops, would have taped postcards of the Alps around the circumference of a big, cheap, wavery mirror, who would have been faithful to his stout wife for the rest of his life. Neumann I says, "Time for haircuts." He sets a stool on the sidewalk and throws a mostly clean towel over Bernd's shoulders and snips away. Werner finds a state-sponsored station playing waltzes and sets the speaker in the open back door of the Opel so all can hear. Neumann I cuts Bernd's hair, then Werner's, then pouchy, wrecked Neumann II's. Werner watches Folkheimer climb the stool and close his eyes when a particularly plangent waltz comes on. Folkheimer, who has killed 100 men by now at least, probably more, walking into pathetic radio-transmitting shacks in his huge expropriated boots, sneaking up behind some emaciated Ukrainian with headphones on his ears and a microphone at his lips, and shooting him in the back of the head, then going to the truck to tell Werner to collect the transmitter, making the order calmly, sleepily, even with the pieces of the man on the transmitter like that. Folkheimer, who always makes sure there's food for Werner, who brings him eggs, who shares his broth, whose fondness for Werner remains, it seems, unshakable. The Augarten proves a thorny place to search, full of narrow streets and tall apartment houses. Transmissions both pass through the buildings and reflect off them.
That afternoon, long after the stool has been put away and the waltzes have stopped, while Werner sits with his transceiver listening to nothing, a little red-headed girl in a maroon cape emerges from a doorway, maybe 6 or 7 years old, small for her age, with big, clear eyes that remind him of Jutta's. She runs across the street to the park and plays there alone, beneath the budding trees, while her mother stands on the corner and bites the tips of her fingers. The girl climbs into the swing and pendulums back and forth, pumping her legs and watching her open some valve in Werner's soul. "This is life," he thinks. "This is why we live. To play like this on a day when winter is finally releasing its grip." He waits for Neumann II to come around the truck and say something crass to spoil it. But he doesn't. And neither does Bernd. Maybe they don't see her at all. Maybe this one pure thing will escape their defilement. And the girl sings as she swings, a high song that Werner recognizes. A counting song that girls jumping rope in the alley behind Children's House used to sing. Eins, zwei, Polizei, drei, vier, Offizier. And how he would like to join her, push her higher and higher, sing. Fünf, sechs, alte Hex, sieben, acht, gute Nacht. Then her mother calls something Werner cannot hear and takes the girl's hand. They pass around a corner, little velvet cape trailing behind, and are gone. Not an hour later, he snares something winging in out of the static, a simple broadcast in Swiss German. Hit 9, transmitting at 1600. This is KX46, do you receive? He does not understand all of it. Then it goes. Werner crosses the square and tunes the second transceiver himself. When they speak again, he triangulates and plugs the numbers into the equation, then looks up and sees with his naked eye what looks very much like a wire antenna trailing down the side of an apartment house flanking the square. So easy. Already, Volkheimer's eyes have come alive, a lion who has caught the scent, as though he and Werner hardly need to speak to communicate. "See the wire trailing down there?" Werner asks. Volkheimer glasses the building with binoculars. "That window?" "Yes." "It's not too dense in here? All these flats?" "That's the window," says Werner. They go in. He does not hear any shots. 5 minutes later, they call him up into a fifth-floor flat, wallpapered with a dizzying floral print. He expects to be asked to look over the equipment, as usual. But there is none. No corpses, no transmitter. Not even a simple listening set. Just ordnance lamps and an embroidered sofa and the swarming rococo wallpaper. "Pry up the floorboards," orders Volkheimer. But after Neumann pries up several and peers down, it's clear that the only thing under the boards is decades-old horsehair for insulation. "Another flat, maybe? Another floor?" Werner crosses into a bedroom and slides open the window and peers over an iron balcony. What he thought was an antenna is nothing more than a painted rod run up the side of a pilaster, probably meant to anchor a clothesline. Not an antenna after all. But he heard a transmission. Didn't he? An ache reaches up through the base of his skull. He laces his hands behind his head and sits on the edge of an unmade bed and looks at the clothes here. A slip folded over the back of a chair, a pewter-backed hairbrush on the bureau, rows of tiny frosted bottles and pots on a vanity. All of it inarticulably feminine to him. Mysterious and confusing, in the way Herr Siedler's wife confused him 4 years before as she hitched up her skirt and knelt in front of the big radio. A woman's room. Wrinkled sheets, a smell like skin lotion in the air. And a photograph of a young man, nephew, lover, brother, on a dressing table. Maybe his math was wrong. Maybe the signals scattered off the buildings. Maybe the fever had scrambled his wits. On the wallpaper in front of him, roses appear to drift, rotate, swap places.
Nothing? Calls Folkheimer from the other room, and Bernd calls back. Nothing.
In some alternate universe, Werner considers, this woman and Frau Elena could have been friends. A reality more pleasant than this one. Then he sees, hung on the doorknob, a maroon square of velvet, hood attached, a child's cape. And at exactly that moment in the other bedroom, Neumann II makes a cry like a high, surprised gargle, and there is a single shot, then a woman's scream, then more shots, and Volkheimer strides past, hurrying, and the rest follow, and they find Neumann II standing in front of a closet with both hands on his rifle and the smell of gunpowder all around. On the floor is a woman, one arm swept backward as if she has been refused a dance. And inside the closet is not a radio, but a child sitting on her bottom with a bullet through her head. Her moon eyes are open and moist, and her mouth is stretched back in an oval of surprise, and it is the girl from the swings, and she cannot be over 7 years old. Werner waits for the child to blink. Blink, he thinks. Blink. 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 Already Volkheimer is closing the closet door, though it won't close all the way because the girl's foot is sticking out of it, and Bernd is covering the woman on the bed with a blanket. And how could Neumann II not have known? But of course he didn't, because that is how things are with Neumann II. With everybody in this unit, in this army, in this world. They do as they're told. They get scared. They move about with only themselves in mind. Name me someone who does not. Neumann I shoulders out, something rancid in his eyes. Neumann II stands there with his new haircut, his fingers playing senseless trills on the stock of his rifle. Why did they hide? He says. Folkheimer tucks the child's foot gently back inside the closet.
There's no radio here, he says, and shuts the door.
Threads of nausea reach up around Werner's windpipe. Outside, the street lamps shudder in the late wind. Clouds ride west over the city. Werner climbs into the opal, feeling as if the buildings are rearing around him, growing taller and warping. He sits with his forehead against the listening decks and is sick between his shoes. So really, children, mathematically, all of light is invisible. Bernd climbs in and pulls the door shut, and the opal comes to life, tilting as it rounds a corner. And Werner can feel the streets rising around them, whirling slowly into an engulfing spiral, into the center of which the truck will arc downward, tracing deeper and deeper all the time. Leagues Under the Sea. On the floor outside Marie-Laure's bedroom waits something big wrapped in newsprint and twine. From the stairwell, Etienne says, Happy 16th birthday. She tears away the paper. Two books, one stacked atop the other. 3 years and 4 months have passed since Papa left Saint-Malo. 1,224 days. Almost 4 years have passed since she had felt Braille, and yet the letters rise from her memory as if she left off reading yesterday. Jules Verne, 20,000 Leagues, Part 1, Part 2. She throws herself at her great-uncle and hangs her arms around his neck.
You said you never got to finish. I thought, rather than my reading it to you, maybe you could read it to me.
But how?
Monsieur Ebrard, the bookseller.
When nothing is available and they're so expensive?
You've made a lot of friends in this town, Marie-Laure.
She stretches out on the floor and opens to the first page. I'm going to start it all over again. From the beginning.
Perfect.
Chapter 1, she reads. A Shifting Reef. The year 1866 was marked by a strange event, an unexplainable occurrence which is undoubtedly still fresh in everyone's memory. She gallops through the first 10 pages, the story coming back, worldwide curiosity about what must be a mythical sea monster, famed marine biologist Professor Pierre Aronnax setting off to discover the truth. Is it monster or moving reef? Something else? Any page now, Aronnax will plunge over the rail of the frigate. Not long afterward, he and the Canadian harpooner Ned Land will find themselves on Captain Nemo's submarine. Beyond the carton-covered window, rain sifts down from a platinum-colored sky. A dove scrambles along the gutter calling, "Hoo, hoo, hoo." Out in the harbor, a sturgeon makes a single leap, like a silver horse, and then is gone. Telegram. A new garrison commander has arrived on the Emerald Coast, a colonel. Trim, smart, efficient. One medals at Stalingrad, wears a monocle, invariably accompanied by a gorgeous French secretary interpreter who may or may not have consorted with Russian royalty. He is average-sized and prematurely gray, but by some contrivance of carriage and posture, he makes the men who stand before him feel smaller. The rumor is that this colonel ran an entire automobile company before the war, that he is a man who understands the power of the German soil, who feels its dark prehistoric vigor thudding in his very cells, that he will never acquiesce. Every night he sends telegrams from the district office in Saint-Malo. Among the 16 official communiques sent on the 30th of April 1944 is a missive to Berlin. Notice of terrorist broadcasts in Côte d'Armor. We believe Saint-Lunaire, or Dinard, or Saint-Malo, or Cancale. Request assistance to locate and eliminate. Dot, dot, dash, dash. Off it goes into the wires, belted across Europe. Chapter 8. 9 August 1944. Fort National. On the third afternoon of the siege of Saint-Malo, the shelling lulls as though all the artillerymen abruptly fell asleep at their guns. Trees burn, cars burn, houses burn. German soldiers drink wine in blockhouses. A priest in the college cellar scatters holy water on the walls. Two horses, gone mad with fear, kick through the door of the garage in which they've been shut and gallop between the smoldering houses on the Grand Rue. Around 4 o'clock, an American field howitzer 2 miles away lets fly a single, improperly ranged shell. It sails over the city walls and bursts against a northern parapet of Fort National, where 380 Frenchmen are being held against their will with minimal cover. 9 are killed instantly, one of them still clutching the hand of bridge he was playing when the shell struck. In the attic. For all of Marie-Laure's 4 years in Saint-Malo, the bells at Saint-Vincent have marked the hours. But now the bells have ceased. She does not know how long she has been trapped in the attic, or even if it is day or night. Time is a slippery thing. Lose hold of it once, and its string might sail out of your hands forever. Her thirst becomes so acute she considers biting into her own arm to drink the liquid that courses there. She takes the cans of food from her great-uncle's coat and sets her lips on their rims. Both taste of tin, their contents just a millimeter away. "Don't risk it," says the voice of her father. "Don't risk the noise." "Just one, Papa. I will save the other. The German is gone. Almost certainly he is gone by now." "Why hasn't the tripwire sprung?" "Because he cut the wire. Or I slept through the bell. Any of a half dozen other reasons. Why would he leave when what he seeks is here?" Who knows what he seeks? You know what he seeks.
I am so hungry, Papa.
Try to think about something else.
Roaring falls of clear, cool water.
You will survive, ma chérie.
How can you know?
Because of the diamond in your coat pocket. Because I left it here to protect you.
All it has done is put me in more danger.
Then why hasn't the house been hit? Why hasn't it caught fire?
It's a rock, Papa. A pebble. There is only luck, bad or good, chance and physics, remember?
You are alive.
I am only alive because I have not yet died.
Do not open the can. He will hear you. He will not hesitate to kill you.
How can he kill me if I cannot die?
Round and round the questions run. Marie-Laure's mind threatens to boil over. Just now she has pulled herself up onto the piano bench at the end of the attic and is running her hands over Etienne's transmitter, trying to apprehend its switches and coils. Here the phonograph, here the microphone, here one of four leads connected to the pair of batteries, when she hears something below her.
A voice.
Very carefully she lowers herself off the bench and presses her ear to the floor. He is directly below her, urinating into the sixth-floor toilet, dribbling out a sad, intermittent trickle, and groaning as though the process causes him torment. Between groans he calls,
Das Heuschenfeld, wo bist du, Heuschen?
Something is wrong with him.
Das Heuschenfeld, wo bist du, Heuschen?
No replies. Whom is he talking to? From somewhere beyond the house comes the thump of distant mortars and the screech of shells hurtling overhead. She listens to the German move from the toilet toward her bedroom, limping that same limp, muttering, unhinged.
Heuschen. What does it mean?
The springs of her mattress creak. She would know that sound anywhere. Has he been sleeping in her bed all this time? Six deep reports sound one after the other, deeper than anti-aircraft guns, farther away.
Naval guns.
Then come drums, cymbals, the gongs of explosions drawing a crimson lattice over the roof. The lull is ending. Abyss in her gut. Desert in her throat. Marie-Laure takes one of the cans of food from her coat. The brick and the knife within reach.
Don't.
If I keep listening to you, Papa, I will die of starvation with food in my hands.
Her bedroom below remains quiet. The shells come patiently, each round whizzing at a predictable interval, scratching a long scarlet parabola over the roof. She uses their noise to open the can.
Shh, goes the shell.
Dink, goes the brick onto the knife onto the can. Dull, terrible detonation everywhere. Shells splinter, zinging into the walls of a dozen houses.
Ch-tink, ch-tink.
With each blow, a prayer.
Do not let him hear.
Five bashes and it's leaking liquid. With the sixth, she manages to saw open a quadrant and bend up the lid with the blade of the knife. She raises it and drinks.
Cool, salty.
It is beans.
Canned, cooked green beans. The water they have been boiled in is supremely tasty. Her whole body seems to reach up to absorb it. She empties the can. Inside her head, her father has gone quiet.
The Heads. Werner weaves the antenna through the rubbled ceiling and touches it to a twisted pipe. Nothing. On his hands and knees, he drags the aerial around the circumference of the cellar, as though roping Volkheimer into the golden armchair. Nothing. He switches off the dying flashlight and mashes the headset against his good ear, and shuts his eyes against the darkness and turns on the repaired transceiver and runs the needle up and down the tuning coil, condensing all his senses into one. Static. 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 Maybe they are buried too deeply. Maybe the rubble of the hotel creates an electromagnetic shadow. Maybe something fundamental is broken in the radio that Werner has not identified. Or maybe the Führer's super scientists have engineered a weapon to end all weapons, and this whole corner of Europe is a shattered waste and Werner and Folkheimer are the only ones left. He takes off the headphones and breaks the connection. The rations are long gone, the canteens are empty, and the sludge in the bottom of the bucket full of paintbrushes is undrinkable. Both he and Folkheimer have gagged down several mouthfuls, and Werner is not sure he can stomach any more. The battery inside the radio is nearly dead. Once it's gone, they'll have the big American 11-volt with the black cat printed on the side. And then? How much oxygen does a person's respiratory system exchange for carbon dioxide every hour? There was a time when Werner would have loved to solve that puzzle. Now he sits with Folkheimer's two stick grenades in his lap, feeling the last bright things inside him fizzle out. Tuning the shaft of one and then the other, he'd ignite their fuses just to light this place up, just to see again. Folkheimer is taken to switching on his field light and focusing its frail beam into the far corner, where 8 or 9 white plaster heads stand on 2 shelves, several toppled onto their sides. They look like the heads of mannequins, only more skillfully fashioned. 3 with mustaches, 2 bald, 1 wearing the cap of a soldier. Even with the light off, the heads assume strange power in the dark. Pure white, not quite visible but not entirely invisible, embedded into Werner's retinas, almost glowing in the blackness. Silent and watchful and unblinking. Tricks of the mind. Faces. Look away. In the blackness he crawls toward Folkheimer, a comfort to find his friend's huge knees in the darkness. The rifle beside him, Bernd's corpse somewhere beyond. Werner says, "Did you ever hear the stories they told about you?"
"Who?"
"The boys at Schulpforte."
"A few I heard."
"Did you like it? Being the giant? Having everyone afraid of you?"
"It's not so fun being asked how tall you are all the time." A shell detonates somewhere above ground.
Somewhere out there, the city burns. The sea breaks. Barnacles beat their feathery arms. "How tall are you?" Folkheimer snorts once, a bark of a laugh. "Do you think Berndt was right about the grenades?"
"No," says Folkheimer, his voice coming alert. "They would kill us.
Even if we built some kind of barrier?"
"We'd be crushed."
Werner tries to make out the heads across the cellar in the blackness. If not the grenades, then what? Does Folkheimer really believe someone is going to come and save them? That they deserve saving?
"So we're just gonna wait?"
Folkheimer doesn't answer.
"For how long?"
When the radio batteries die, the American's 11-volt should run the transceiver for one more day. Or he could wire the bulb from Folkheimer's field light to it. The battery will give them one more day of static, or one more day of light. But they will not need the light to use the rifle. Delirium. A purple fringe flutters around von Rumpel's vision. Something must have gone wrong with the morphine. He may have taken too much. Or else the disease has advanced far enough to alter his sight. Ash drifts through the window like snow. Is it dawn? The glow in the sky could be the light from fires. Sheets soaked in sweat, his uniform as wet as if he had been swimming in his sleep, the taste of blood in his mouth. He crawls to the end of the bed and looks at the model. He has studied every square inch of it, bashed a corner to pieces with the butt of a wine bottle.
The structures in it are mostly hollow. The chateau, the cathedral, the market. But why bother to smash them all when one is missing? The very house he needs. Out in the forsaken city, every other structure, it seems, is burning or collapsing. But here, in front of him, is the inverse in the miniature. The city remains, but the house he occupies is gone. Could the girl have carried it out with her when she fled? Possible. The uncle didn't have it when they sent him to Fort National. He was well searched. He carried nothing but his papers. Von Rumpel made sure of it. Somewhere, a wall goes to pieces, 1,000 kilograms of masonry crashing down. That the house stands while so many others have been destroyed is evidence enough. The stone must be inside. He simply needs to find it while there is time. Clamp it to his heart and wait for the goddess to thrust her fiery hand through its planes and burn away his affliction. Burn his way out of this citadel, out of this siege, out of this disease. He will be saved. He simply has to drag himself up from this bed and keep looking. Do it more methodically. As many hours as it takes, tear the place apart. Begin in the kitchen. One more time. Water. Marie-Laure hears the springs of her bed groan, hears the German limp out of her room and go down the stairs. Is he leaving? Giving up? It starts to rain. Thousands of tiny drops thrum onto the roof. Marie-Laure stands on her tiptoes and presses her ear to the roofing beneath the slates, listens to the drops trickle down. What was the prayer? The one Madame Manic murmured to herself on Bastille Day as the fireworks went up. Lord our God, your grace is a purifying fire. She has to marshal her mind, use perception and logic, as her father would. As Jules Verne's great marine biologist Professor Pierre Aronnax would. The German does not know about the attic. She has the stone in her pocket. She has one can of food. These are advantages. The rain is good, too. It will stifle the fires. Could she capture some of it to drink? Punch a hole in the slates. Use it in some other way. Maybe to cover her noise? She knows exactly where the 2 galvanized buckets are, just inside the door of her room. She can get to them. Maybe even carry one back up. No. Carrying it up would be impossible, too heavy, too noisy, all that water sloshing everywhere. But she could go to one and lower her face into it. She could fill the empty can of beans. The very thought of her lips against water, the tip of her nose touching its surface, summons up a biological craving beyond anything she has experienced. In her mind, she falls into a lake. Water fills her ears and mouth. Her throat opens. One sip and she could think more clearly. She waits for her father's voice in her head to raise an objection, but none comes. The distance through the front of the wardrobe, across Henri's room, across the landing, and to her doorway runs 21 paces, give or take. She takes the knife and the empty can from the floor and tucks them in her pocket. She creeps down the 7 ladder rungs and stays fixed for a long time against the back of the wardrobe. Listening, listening, listening. The little wooden house is a bump against her ribs as she crouches. Inside its tiny attic, does some tiny likeness of Marie-Laure wait, listening? Does that tiny version of her feel this same thirst? The only sound is the patter of rain turning Saint-Malo into mud. It could be a trick. Maybe he has heard her open the can of beans, went noisily downstairs, and climbed quietly back up. Maybe he stands outside the big wardrobe with his pistol drawn. Lord our God, your grace is a purifying fire. She flattens her hands against the back of the wardrobe and slides open the panel. The shirts drag across her face as she crawls through. She sets her hands against the inside of the wardrobe doors and nudges one open. No gunshot. Nothing. Out the now glassless window, the sound of rain falling on the burning houses is the sound of pebbles being stirred by waves. Marie-Laure steps onto the floor of her grandfather's old bedroom and summons him. A curious boy with lustrous hair who smells of the sea. He's playful, quick-witted, charged with energy. He takes one of her hands while Etienne finds the other. The house becomes as it was 50 years ago. The boy's well-dressed parents laugh downstairs. A cook shucks oysters in the kitchen. Madame Manic, a young maid fresh from the countryside, sings on a stepladder as she dusts the chandelier.
Papa, you had the keys to everything.
The boys lead her into the hall. She passes the bathroom. Traces of the German's smell hang in her bedroom, an odor like vanilla. Beneath it, something putrid. She cannot hear anything beyond the rain outside and her own pulse discharging in her temples. She kneels as soundlessly as she can and runs her hands along the grooves of the floor. The sound of her fingertips striking the bucket's side seems louder than the gong of a cathedral bell. Rain hums against the roof and walls, drips past the glassless window. All around her wait her pebbles and seashells, her father's model, her quilt. Somewhere in here must be her shoes. She lowers her face and touches her lips to the water's surface. Each swallow seems as loud as a shell burst. 1, 3, 5. She gulps breaths. Her entire head inside the bucket. Breathing. Dying. Dreaming. Does he stir? Is he downstairs? Is he coming back up? 9, 11, 13. She is full. Her whole gut stretches, sloshes. She has had too much. She slips the can into the bucket and lets it fill. Now, to retreat without making a sound, without bumping a wall, the door, without tripping, without spilling. She turns and begins to crawl, the full can of water in her left hand. Marie-Laure makes the doorway of her room before she hears him. He is 3 or 4 stories below, ransacking one of the rooms. She hears what sounds like a crate of ball bearings get dumped onto the floor. They bounce, clatter, and roll. She reaches out her right hand, and here, just inside of the doorway, she discovers something big and rectangular and hard, covered with cloth. Her book. The novel, sitting right here as though her father has placed it for her. The German must have tossed it off her bed. She lifts it as quietly as she can and holds it against the front of her uncle's coat. Can she make it downstairs? Can she slip past him and into the street? But already the water is filling her capillaries, improving the flow of her blood. Already she is thinking more keenly. She does not want to die. Already she has risked too much. Even if she could miraculously slip past the German, there is no promise that the streets will be safer than the house. She makes it to the landing. Makes it to the threshold of her grandfather's bedroom. Feels her way to the wardrobe, climbs through the open doors, and closes them gently behind her. The beams. Shells are careening overhead, quaking the cellar like passing freight trains. Werner imagines the American artillerymen, spotters with scopes balanced on rocks or tank treads or hotel railings, firing officers computing wind speed, barrel elevation, air temperature, radio men with telephone receivers pressed to their ears calling in targets. Right 3 degrees. Repeat range. Calm, weary voices directing fire. The same sort of voice God uses, perhaps, when he calls souls to him. This way, please. Only numbers. Pure math. You have to accustom yourself to thinking that way. It's the same on their side, too.
My great-grandfather, Volkheimer says all of a sudden, was a sawyer in the years before steamships, when everything went by sail.
Werner can't be sure in the blackness, but he thinks Volkheimer is standing, running his fingertips along one of the three splintered beams that hold up the ceiling, his knees bent to accommodate his height, like Atlas about to slip into the traces.
"Back then," Volkheimer says, "all of Europe needed masts for their navies, but most of the countries had cut down their big trees. England, great-grandfather said, didn't have a tree worth its wood on the whole island. So the masts for the British and Spanish navies, the Portuguese too, would come from Prussia, from the woods where I grew up. Great-grandfather knew where all the giants were. Some of those trees would take a crew of 5 men 3 days to bring down. First, the wedges would go in like needles, he said, in the hide of an elephant. The biggest trunks could swallow 100 wedges before they'd creak. The artillery screams. The cellar shudders. And great-grandfather said he loved to imagine the big trees sledding behind teams of horses across Europe, across rivers, across the sea to Britain, where they'd be stripped and treated and raised up again as masts, where they'd see decades of battle given a second life, sailing atop the great oceans until eventually they'd fall and die their second death. Another shell goes overhead, and Werner imagines he hears the wood and the huge beams above him splinter. That chunk of coal was once a green plant, a fern or reed that lived 1 million years ago, or maybe 2 million, or maybe 100 million. Can you imagine 100 million years? Werner says, "Where I'm from, they dug up trees. Prehistoric ones." Volkheimer says, "I was desperate to leave."
"I was too."
"And now?"
Bernd molders in the corner.
Jutta moves through the world somewhere, watching shadows disentangle themselves from night, watching miners limp past in the dawn. It was enough when Werner was a boy, wasn't it? A world of wildflowers blooming up through the shapes of rusty cast-off parts. A world of berries and carrot peels and Frau Elena's fairy tales. Of the sharp smell of tar and trains passing, and bees humming in the window boxes. String and spit and wire, and a voice on the radio offering a loom on which to spin his dreams. The transmitter. It waits on the table tucked against the chimney, the twin marine batteries below it. A strange machine built years before to talk to a ghost. As carefully as she can, Marie-Laure crawls to the piano bench and eases herself up. Someone must have a radio. The fire brigade, if one remains, or the resistance, or the Americans hurling missiles at the city. The Germans in their underground forts. Maybe Etienne himself. She tries to imagine him hunched somewhere, his fingers twisting the dials of a phantom radio. Maybe he assumes she is dead. Maybe he needs only to hear a flicker of hope. She runs her fingers along the stones of the chimney until she finds the lever her uncle installed there. She presses her whole weight on it, and the antenna makes a faint, grating noise above the roof as it telescopes upward. Too loud. She waits. Counts to 100, no sound from downstairs. Beneath the table, her fingers find switches, one for the microphone, the other for the transmitter. She cannot remember which is which. Switch on one, then the other. Inside the big transmitter, vacuum tubes thrum.
"Is it too loud, Papa?"
No louder than the breeze, the undertone of the fires. She traces the lines of the cable until she is sure she has the microphone in her hand. To shut your eyes is to guess nothing of blindness. Beneath your world of skies and faces and buildings exists a rawer, an older world, a place where surface planes disintegrate and sounds ribbon in shoals through the air. Marie-Laure can sit in an attic high above the street and hear lilies rustling in marshes 2 miles away.
She hears Americans scurry across farm fields, directing their huge cannons at the smoke of Saint-Malo. She hears families sniffling around hurricane lamps in cellars